member of the Unacceptables. My mind is malignant.
Today, I open up my book for all to see. The words I speak are mine alone today.
Yes.
No offenses, no pretenses, just poetry.
Welcome to Griot Silenci.
So I am here with Joseph Felton.
Hello.
Joseph Felton, as we spoke in our previous podcast, is a postdoc here at the University of Texas in Dallas. He is working on a project in solar energy. But he is a historian at heart. If he had a choice, he'd probably be teaching history somewhere. Well, of course he has a choice. Why don't you teach history?
I honestly, because the history professor market is wildly saturated versus how many history professor jobs are out there.
Saturated?
Yeah, you get like 500 applicants per like opening for a tenure track professor nowadays.
Get out of here.
Yeah, it's insane.
I didn't know history was a...
It's a wildly competitive field. It's
or
wild.
Is it just not enough There's, space for history professors in universities?
I mean, the thing is, a lot of universities don't want to pay for tenured professors. They'd rather have adjuncts and part-time teachers because they're cheaper. Of course, they may give starvation wages, but that's not their problem. Mm-hmm. That's the lecturer's problem. So, like, the number of history professor positions open are far, far fewer than people who want to do history PhDs. If I was born a rich man's son and could, like, fail endlessly until I found a position, I'd be like, yeah, sure, whatever. Mm-hmm. I am not a rich man's son. So, I'm like, no. That's all. But I still, like, as, like, an amateur, I guess, call it consumer of history... Love poking at, I don't produce history texts. I don't do like anthropological research and try to, you know, piece together like bits and bobs of the historical record. So I don't know if I'm a history professor or a historian, nor do I like keep records of what's happening now besides checking the news and being like, ah, crap, I don't like that. But I mean, so I guess the better to call it a consumer of history. But yeah, I like seeing, you know, history and technology and how that intersects here and there.
As a history consumer, let me ask you the one of the biggest questions.
Uh-oh.
Have we learned from our history?
Never. Never. Like, the people who usually make decisions are not going to be the ones, are making decisions based upon... you know, their personal wants and needs and not like some kind of historical record of, well, what happened when somebody tried doing what I want to do now? No one, the people who usually rise to the top of any society are not the ones that are reflective so much as they are aggressive and, you know, pro-social and able to like convince other people. None of these things are, none of the things that are necessary to usually be at the top dog of any society, any government, require you to be one of those contemplative, like, reflective people. So generally you don't, like, look... Generally those people are not, you know, even merely consumers of history. So, I mean, there are people who have, you know, you could say, yeah, of course this is dumb in historical context, but none of these people are making that many decisions in the grand scheme of things. So, I mean, we could learn from history. We do not set up our society... to promote the people who are willing to do so into positions where decisions are made. Mm-hmm. You know? I'm veering into politics again. I mean, if I finish another... give me a drink or two, and I guess I'll start singing the Internationale or something.
I just wonder how the world would be different if, as a society, we put more cultural value into...
Understanding
our history, what went wrong, and how we might better move forward. Which brings me to today's topic, culture as a technology.
Yes.
So culture as a technology is something you have found quite an interest in.
Whether or not it's actually a real... It's more of an idea I worry over. I don't know if it's, like, truly legitimate... quote-unquote, for serious inquiry. but it's kind of perspective that I haven't given up on yet. Of can one view the culture of a society as a technology unto itself, or as like a sorting algorithm, perhaps, for what do we prioritize on, you know, research, cultural values, expenditures of our society, and so on and so forth. Like, I remember reading up on, like, Meso and Southern American history, and unlike what I kind of had for, like, high school history class, like, you know, the Incas specifically and their neighboring cultures all had, you know, fairly advanced metallurgical skills. They didn't have iron or steel swords, but that's because they didn't approach using iron as making a weapon. Most of their metalworking all over has been basically, how do we make these decorative objects? And, you know, you talk about, like, yeah, what was it? Cortez was Mexico. And who was the guy? All right.
Don't ask me.
I know. American, our pre-Columbian, our Colombian, post-Columbian history class. But the Spaniards who basically took over the Incan Empire were like, they, you know, those vaults of gold, that the gold loot and booty were not something that just kind of, you know, came out of thin air. It took, you know, it took them having a metallurgical tradition of, you know, working with gold, working with silver, working with all these precious and rare metals, but, you know, ultimately metalworking, right? Mm-hmm. To assume, like, we have these, like, modern day cultural assumptions of a technology gap, quote unquote, that is not as wide as we might think it was, like, you know, nowadays versus kind of poking in the histories. Like, you know, the Incas had, like, suspension bridges and stuff like that that were pretty unfamiliar to Spaniards and all this other stuff, and they had all this advanced metallurgical workings, but they didn't think of making that stuff into weapons, unlike the Spaniards. And perhaps that may have done, you know, with the long history of...
Or at least to a larger degree, yeah. Weapons.
Yeah, like, well, they still had weapons. A lot of the stuff, as I understood it, was based in obsidian, which is hard, is very brittle, but can also be extremely sharp and arguably sharper than what you can make most, like, steel scalpels. Like for surgeons, like, as I understand it, I'm not sure if it's current or if it's only been up to recently, but obsidian scalpels were considered, you know, of superior quality for, you know, fine surgical work. I don't remember if that's been superseded by now, but there was a period where obsidian, like, once you sharpen it and, you know, flint nap it down to the right size and shape and what you need for, was a better tool for being sharp. Granted, you can't make an obsidian sword, but, you know, what they did was they took, you know, sharp bits of obsidian and jammed it into, you know, sticks and said, boom, sharp axe. You know, so it's different. Granted, steel is way better in conjunction with the chemistry of gunpowder to make a gun. But again, you know, it's not like the Spaniards were the first ones to come up with guns or arquebuses or anything along those lines. They're the first ones, or, you know, they're not the first ones to come up with gunpowder, but, I mean, they're kind of the first ones to make a whole bunch of, or, you know, the Europeans in general were kind of the first ones to do a whole bunch of, like, technology of guns. Because, mm-hmm. you know, you can talk about gunpowder from China, and, you know,
what
metallurgy
exactly
from
in the
India.
Particular case of the Aztecs as compared to the Spaniards? Going back to the point that they used their iron and...
Yeah, they had different cultural priorities to what to do with their resources. Yeah, like the accounts talk about the cleanliness of the cities and the organization of those cities and their advanced sewer systems.
What kind of factors do you think would have led to them to having those kind of cultural values compared to Spaniards?
See, I don't know precisely at this moment. I have something I want to read is I believe it's the Franciscan Codex, where they talk about they use the word Nahua, I could be getting this wrong, but as like a general catch-all term for like Mesoamerican that they referred to as themselves, right? And there's like the Nahua, like, philosophy, our you know, cultural philosophy had some interesting counterpoints to like the Greek philosophy that a lot of Western like culture kind of base itself around, where it's kind of a more collectivist approach. Like, I know we talk about Montezuma and the human sacrifice and this, that, and the other, but that was actually a historically recent thing invented to justify the expansion of empire. It was like less than 100 years that the Aztecs were actually doing human sacrifice since Cortez, like, you know, came and landed in Mesoamerica. So, I mean, that's like a weird historical quirk. Again, I could be getting a lot of this wrong historically, but this is what I understand from like general interest reading and what I remember offhand. Okay. So if someone hears this and says, "Hey, you're wrong," you know what? Yeah, you're probably right. I'm probably getting something wrong here. I'm literally an amateur consumer of historian, amateur consumer of history, and a glorified fancy blacksmith, which is why I like, you know, looking at it from that lens, even if I still come from the European cultural context.
The metallurgy.
Yeah, for undergrad, I was a physics and materials engineering major. I did physics. I did two majors of physics and material engineering, but the materials engineering was very much a focus on metallurgy. Mm. You know, the
what kind of market, or what's the biggest market for materials right now?
The single biggest market period of any material is oil, and consequently plastics, petrochemicals, you know, gasoline, blah, 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 blah. I'm not sure if that's the right thing. Are you talking about, like, steel? It's, like, still number one thing you use for that is construction. The number one use of silicon is computer chips and slowly coming up to be solar cells, but it's computer chips number one and number two, essentially, for that one. But, yeah, like, what material you're talking about determines what kind of market you're worrying about or thinking about with that material. So, I mean, yeah, the biggest internationally traded commodity, though, is oil. The second biggest, I think the second biggest commodity in the world is traded, like something like coffee, which makes me quietly amused. This is like, yes, coffee everywhere. Mm.
Of course, we have to be up longer so we can be more productive, right?
Yes, more wake-up juice. I mean, and it's a weird cultural thing because, I mean, what, other places use, like, coca leaves, but...
To stay up.
For a wake, yeah. This was actually a thing with the Evo Morales and like Bolivian indigenous culture, was that, you know, coca leaves had a whole bunch of uses other than making that lovely white powder that people like to snort, cocaine. But you can, like, it's apparently it's been used for things like altitude sickness and as, like, you know, like as a tea for staying awake or, you know, keeping awake and up like that. But yeah, it's not like highly concentrated like powder cocaine or whatever. But yeah, it's like there's uses for that. And like, I'm not going to advocate, yeah, go snort some cocaine, whoever listens to this. But I mean, there have been cultures that have used a very dilute form of it in a similar way to like coffee. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, nor would I recommend somebody snort caffeine pills for that matter, if we're talking about snorting, you know, white powders here. Gosh, that sounds scary.
So this might be oversimplifying it, but let's use this cocoa metaphor.
Cocoa leaves?
So some people find it more valuable to use cocoa leaves for cocaine, some for snorting, for, you know, staying up. Perhaps they have some medicinal values, and all this depends on, you know, personal preference.
Which is, you know, fed into by what are the cultural
which is
values.
Fed into by the cultural values of the... But even in this society where we, you know, we embody the whole idea of we are individuals, you know, individualization, we have our own thoughts and all that stuff.
That is a philosophical, or that is a cultural thing. Like, talking about Mesoamerica and the Franciscan Codex, like I mentioned kind of vaguely earlier and then wandered off from... One of the things I found interesting about that was that there was, you know, this is secondhand, I have not sat down and read it, but like people who have, you know, read it and talked about it have kind of mentioned that their sense of moral philosophy was based upon a group effort. So perhaps that lends itself to, like, you know, more public works, more public projects, stuff like that. Like, you know, if a person, like the example that I was taught, again, this is all secondhand, and I want to sit down and read it. I probably need to learn Spanish and then learn to, you know, understand that better or find a good translation, which I haven't found, is that, you know, we are responsible for each other's foibles, that, you know, if somebody is like a candy addict or sweets addict, that you don't just leave like a bowl of like candy bars out in front of them and just kind of be like, yeah, whatever. But if their person just compulsively, you know, steals from them, like let's say Halloween comes by, you didn't have that many trick-or-treaters, and you have this bowl of candy still, instead of just leaving it for your friend to just keep on eating from it and get like sick from it, you just bring it into your workplace and hand it out to a whole bunch of different people, and that way they're removed from that temptation. Like that was considered a positive moral thing to help look out for people and their foibles, or their, you know, their problems or their, you know, personal failings. Again, I wish I knew more about this, and I wish I was like sat down and had these books and was reading them. But like it was like, as it's been presented to me, it's really kind of neat. And I'm not sure if that would be a very helpful cultural perspective to have nowadays, you know, rather than this, oh, individualism, rah, rah, rah. I mean, we're down to like marketing and like commercials you might see on TV about expressing your individuality by buying this mass produced product, which is kind of weird, but here we are, right?
It's also in the realm of scientific research, it all depends on what kind of funding you can get.
Yep. Yeah, that's also like,
so your individuality as a scientist really has to be tailored towards,
yep,
who's interested in you.
Yeah. Yeah, the way academia works nowadays, I don't know how it was before. All I can do is see the lay of the land where I'm at right now. Is that to be a professor, to be a serious scientist, you gotta go where the money is. You gotta do the research that's the hot topic, the fashionable topic, which I never knew you would have to worry about fashion in science, but fuck it, there it is. Like 10 years ago, it was nano this, nano that. You know, probably another 10 years from now, it'll be energy this, energy that, right? Because, you know, it's as a response to wider cultural obsessions. You know, back in the 1950s, it was rocketry this, rocketry that. Mm-hmm. And we could wonder off into the reasons why, but, you know, I think it's important that every generation of scientists, as far as I can see, at least for the like last generation or two, have had to follow whatever's been in popular imagination to get funded to then do the research on that topic. And if there's an excellent scientist who wants to work on a not-so-popular field that may be actually very valuable and important, too bad. Just doesn't get the funding. Doesn't get to go. It just lies fallow.
So I know that this question of whether culture is a technology is something that you haven't closed. You're still considering it. And
yeah.
Other opinions about it.
Yeah, I could
For me
be
personally,
full of whatever.
I think it makes sense for culture to be a technology. It's the same way you would either make guns or you could make a cult of followers.
Hey
so
there.
You culturally indoctrinate them to believe certain things or do certain things,
yes.
And they become your weapons. So
yes.
Essentially, the human mind, I think, is the strongest weapon. Everything comes from ideas and such.
Yeah, like what happens if the most important thing was to have the coolest looking earrings? What happens if we have like a culture and tech, like a culture that emphasizes like whatever you can have to make the coolest looking earring? Mm-hmm. Is it like the most intricate? Is it like a bunch of blinky lights? Who knows what? And how would we change?
I am.
This is just a pulling this one out of the hat. You ruined the magic of the podcast. By, you know, pointing out that pointing out the inspiration I have for this. But what, you know.
Of course.
Do we have different ways of working metal? Do we have different allocation of resources if everyone
is
just hanging out there trying to have the coolest looking pair of earrings? Mm-hmm. Right?
And one of the things that we are building in the Art Science Lab at University of Dallas is the idea that we can use art in science as a research method, not just art as, you know, the guy you call to make the pretty cover poster for your science journal.
Or to launder
or
money.
Or your science paper, or even to, you know, simply just tell people what you're doing.
Or for money laundering or tax purposes.
Or money laundering and tax purposes.
We like what we do with, like, those $1 million paintings that no one ever sees ever again. They're just stuck in container ships.
Yes.
And priceless art that just gets donated every now and then as a tax write-off. Yeah, it's great. Sorry, yeah. Okay.
But the question is, having that assumption that culture is a technology. Well, I have made that premise. Culture is a technology. How then does one design a culture? And this is a conversation that's been happening in ATEC department. I forget who exactly is leading this project, but it's a statement, designing culture.
That actually, like, random tangential thought about, you know, culture as a technology. And I think in previous discussions we talked about language is part of being upstream of culture, or part of the culture, the cultural determinant. What happens if you had a language that had, you know, zero gendered nouns, pronouns? There's no sexual gender, like no he or him. There's no object gender, like, you know, they have in a lot of languages, like a masculine form for, you know, a bridge, or a feminine form for, you know, a wheel, in terms of like le and la for like Spanish, if I'm getting that right, and die, der, das for German, or there's masculine, feminine, and neutral. What happens if it's all gender neutral? How does that affect, like, you know, a whole bunch of cultural assumptions there? And I have no idea. I mean, I would call you Miss Ian. What happens if everyone was Sir, right? Sir Ian, Sir Joe, Sir William, Sir Sarah. Like, does that change? Is there, like, suddenly, if there's no contrast? Yeah, it's a weird thought, right? Does that mean there are subconscious assumptions for masculine and feminine that just go unexamined if we don't have, like, terms for masculine and feminine? I mean, I assume that we won't all, like, suddenly forget how to reproduce or something. But, I mean, well, will there be what is masculine assumptions and what is feminine assumptions that exist anymore? Mm-hmm. Or, yeah,
well,
does it?
In that particular example, I can imagine that there will be tremendous discrimination.
Based on what, though?
It's like telling the monkey, the whale, the spider, the baby, just telling them all, you're the same, climb the tree. Have you seen that image? It's a very powerful image. Climb the tree and you get assessed based on that.
Yeah. But, I mean...
But, yeah, what would happen if, say, we actually took global warming seriously? What would happen if we actually did that?
I would like to see that. But, I mean, there would be a massive restructuring of society around addressing it.
How would we do that?
How?
Design. How would we design that? So, okay, it's a very sticky thing to talk about designing culture, because...
Yeah. Well, there's more than one way to address global warming. There's the high-tech way, where you bilge out a whole bunch of solar and wind and nuclear, even things that don't produce CO2. And then there is the other way of, okay, let's not run the electricity for anything but the most important stuff, like telecommunications. Let's not spend a lot of energy on transport and have the pace of life go slower. I mean, there's at least two extreme directions you can go on in addressing climate change. You have to build a society around one or the other.
And that's the whole question of designing culture is actually, in a sense, dark. Because...
It's kind of a...
It's like teaching an old dog new tricks. Old saying. It's very hard to change a human being. Let alone a system, let alone a society.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. And usually the people who have tried have ended up doing some horrific things.
Yes. I mean, any culture is not independent of its material conditions either. In the U.S., we have all these suburbs because we can have this tremendous industrial capacity to build a whole bunch of cars. Mm-hmm. If cars were not relatively speaking, cheap and ubiquitous. Nobody. We would not have McKinney. Mm-hmm. Everyone would be smooshed a lot closer to downtown Dallas. And there'd be more streetcars, more public transit, mm-hmm. more bicycles, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, the physical geography of people right now, like here in Dallas-Fort Worth, is very much dependent upon at least the car, right? Mm-hmm. And if all cars disappeared overnight, a lot of things would change.
It's really
real fast.
A feedback loop.
Yes.
Like you say, where we create something and then that thing pushes us to be the way we are.
Yes. I don't think there's a clear one way. It's not material conditions affect culture. Culture affects material conditions. It's not one or the other. It sloshes back and forth, I think. And then, you know, that affects politics. So material conditions is affected by politics, which is affected by culture, which affects politics, which affects its culture, which da-da-da-da-da. And I'm sure I'm missing more, you know, like things that could feed back into each other for it all. So, I mean, it's a big tangled web, and I don't think anyone who thinks that they can do this one thing to change culture or to change society is ever going to get it right, mm-hmm. or is ever going to get, like, a total changeover. I mean...
All right, then. So... If you have any thoughts, any examples, we would love to hear. But this is the end of this podcast. So yeah. Thank you, Joseph. Thank you for sharing this.
Yeah. No, it's fun to sit down and chat.
All right.